Welcome to the EADV podcast. In today's episode, Dr. Sarah Walsh is joined by Dr. Alexander Zink to talk about wearables. Dr. Alexander Zink is a consultant physician and board-certified dermatologist at the Department of Dermatology and Allergy at Technical University of Munich. Dr. Zink specializes in chronic skin diseases, public health, and digital medicine with a focus on prevention and leveraging innovative solutions such as crowdsourced data and wearables. He is also section editor of the JACP. But before we start, a reminder for you.
We are excited to announce an open call for papers on digital intelligence for dermatology for a JADV special issue exploring the world of modern neural networks, big data, and digital technologies transforming dermatology. We welcome clinically oriented submissions, including original articles, reviews, systematic reviews, and meta-analyses. Submit your paper by the 31st of May 2024 and visit eadv.org to learn more.
Together, they discuss wearable technology, particularly in dermatology, where wearables are emerging as an area of research fostered by technological developments. By complementing data collected in more traditional contexts, wearables may improve the outcomes of healthcare for patients. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the EADV podcast. My name's Sarah Walsh. I'm a dermatologist in London. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Alexander Zink, who is the chief senior physician at the Department of Dermatology and Allergy in Munich, and also an adjunct teaching professor at the Technical University of Munich, which was his own alma mater, where he studied medicine. And Alexander, over his professional career, has developed a keen academic interest in crowdsourced data, network analysis, and specifically wearables and their role in dermatology health. So, Alex, your body of work is really, really fascinating. And I wondered if we could take you back a little bit further and begin by telling our listeners a little bit about your training in dermatology since your graduation from the University of Munich in 2011.
Yes, definitely. Hi, Sarah. So I after my graduation in 2011, I started my residency here in Munich at the Technical University of Munich. And back then it was Professor Johannes Ring. So he was my first boss. And then after 2.5 years, he retired and Professor Thilo Biedermann came. So actually I spent all of my residency at the same hospital, but with two different bosses. And of course, it's been two different strategies of approaching dermatology now and then, basically. And that's actually that's also what kind of influenced me. So with Professor Johannes Ring being a very highly recognized professional allergologist as well as a dermatologist, we're at the end of his career, of his professional career as a head of department. And then with Thilo Biedermann as the rising star of dermatology in Germany, taking over this clinic and giving new impact and new strategy.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting point, isn't it? How leadership can really shape a department and shape the interests of the people in the department. It's interesting the way your bosses have obviously influenced your career development. Do you recall any particularly memorable patient encounter from your time as a resident that influenced some of your subsequent career choices?
Definitely. So I'm really interested in patterns of diseases in individuals, but also in patterns of diseases within populations. And that's what struck me in the first 1 or 2, maybe 3 years of my residency. I saw a lot of outdoor workers coming from different parts of Bavaria, mainly farmers, for example. And then I realized, well, they all have the same pattern of non-melanoma skin cancer because obviously that's a risk for them. And then a couple of years later, non-melanoma skin cancer was recognized as an official occupational disease for outdoor professions in Germany. And since then, I believe that the pattern of disease you or an individual develops sort of is connected, of course, to his or her genetics, but also to his or her lifestyle. And then at a main point, also his or her profession. And that's really what influenced me. And then I started a lot of studies in assessing skin diseases in different professions, not only in different outdoor working groups, but also comparing them to, for example, sewage workers or tax workers, whatever. So we did a lot of studies for profession, but then also we looked at populations with a specific interest, with specific hobbies. So, for example, we looked at glider pilots in Bavaria.
Is that a big group of people?
It's not that big, but it's a very homogeneous group. Yeah. So they were very easy to study. And then we looked at water skier, we looked at snow skier, we looked at police, professional policemen working outside. You name the occupation, we had a look at them. And what we found is obviously what we know today is that every profession has a risk for a specific skin disease. And depending on your hobby, of course, you also have a risk for a specific skin disease. And that's where my interest for pattern recognition really, really exploded.
Well, it sounds like a very novel approach to epidemiology. In fact, you make epidemiology sound very exciting when you discuss it in those terms. And can I ask just quickly, you just mentioned that for the agricultural workers, that non-melanoma skin cancer was recognized as an occupational disease. Presumably that has big implications for them in terms of insurance. What are the consequences of it being recognized formally as an occupational disease for this group?
Yeah, so in Germany, if you have a lot of specific possibilities, actually. So of course, the disease is recognized and the insurance company pays for it. So it's not your health insurance, but it's your occupational insurance. And then you even get funding for the prevention. So you even get funding for medical sun protection. And you can see a doctor as often as you have to. It will be covered by the by the insurance company. Other way around, it wouldn't be covered. But it has a lot of benefits. Even you have a specific rent if you're diagnosed with an occupational disease. And that was in 2015 or 16. It started with squamous cell carcinoma and actinic keratosis. And now we're about to add basal cell carcinoma in Germany, specific subtypes, also as an occupational disease for outdoor professions.
So that's an extraordinarily impactful consequence of your research. I'm sure that group is very grateful to you. And just panning back out now, we're looking at your publications. They show a really broad range of interests, from the clinical to the scientific, the qualitative. But particularly recently, there's a strong representation in the domain of technology, social media, and e-health. What first sparked this interest?
Well, already as a boy, I loved technology. And when I got a small car or electrical car for my birthday or for Christmas, I took it apart with my brother to understand how it's working. And then when technology evolved, I sort of stuck with these technological developments. And my home, for example, I have a lot of gadgets. And then combining it with my interest in pattern recognition of diseases, we soon found out that, well, it's very hard to get the data. So where do you get the data from? Because in Germany, we don't have those national patient registries as for example, in Sweden. But then with the social media coming up, with the web searches on Google, for example, with technological gadgets, which are very easily accessible, I realized that's an enormous source of getting real life data for the general population and then for subpopulations. And then I connected my two or three interests and focused on getting publicly available data from social media, from Google, from other web searches, and then of course with the AI-driven natural language processing, chatbots, verbals, and so on. Always keeping in mind to identify the pattern of something specific of diseases in a population.
Mm-hmm. So still coming back to the concept of pattern recognition, which of course is so important to dermatology. And you, I mean, I guess this brings us then to the concept of the wearables. So for the keen epidemiologist, this is basically the ultimate way of gathering data for large numbers easily. Can you just explain just briefly to the listeners what a wearable is? I mean, is a Fitbit, for example, an example of a wearable?
Yeah, Fitbit is a perfect example for a wearable, but it can be anything worn by you. So it could be a watch, it could be a ring, it could be an earring, it could be a necklace, whatever, a bracelet. But it could also be a piece of clothing, a smart T-shirt, a smart hat, for example, or even smart shoes. So the idea is that you put something on and at some point in your body, Elon Musk, the chip in the brain,
That's
not really a wearable, but it's going to be there to track your individual life and get data of your health and then identify the pattern of your individual health.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's such a fascinating area because clearly the power or the potential power of these tools is enormous. And, you know, the example you give of inserting a chip, that is somewhere, that's an example where there is implied consent by the individual who has agreed to have a chip put in. But I imagine that there must be huge potential ethical issues. So, for example, our mobile phones are constantly collecting data about us unwittingly that we haven't explicitly given consent to. I mean, what kind of things do you think we can do as a society to guard against these potential harms of mass data gathering from wearables?
Yeah, well, Sarah, you're completely right. So we have to find solutions for the problem you mentioned. And as always, a new technology can be fascinating, gives us a lot of new potential power, but also a lot of new harmful things. So we have to find a regulation how to use it. And I personally believe that we should focus on the individual AI. So I would imagine that every one of us has as many wearables as he or she likes, has as many smart gadgets in his or her home, in the bathroom, in the car, in your workroom, wherever. Then it's connected to your personal AI only the individual can access. And then the analysis of the individual data, the data owner can share with someone else. Because I personally don't believe that we should look at every single measured time point for a variable, for example, but only by combining the patterns and looking at the individual delta of the pattern. So, for example, someone with atopic dermatitis has a wearable, and that's what we're building in Munich. It's a wearable tracking your skin humidity and your transepidermal water loss. Of course, it's highly individual, but we track it during AD, before a flare-up, after a flare-up, and in healthy skin. And we're not interested in a single time point. We're only interested in the individual delta to look at it from a disease perspective. But of course, we're not there yet. We don't have a personal AI. We only can buy what's on the market. And as you said, usually we have to agree that our data is shared with the companies, with the government, with whatever. And of course, it can be highly sensitive data. Just imagine the wearables, they track your whole life. There's a concept of a smart bathroom, putting in sensors in your toilets, in your mirror, in your shower. So it's the most intimate thing of your life, maybe. And it's you don't want to see it on the internet. So we have to find a solution to
this is very true. Data, of course. And can I ask, I notice that you're also a member of the AI task force for the EADV. Is this part of your agenda, is safeguarding data as well as harnessing it?
Yeah, it's also part of the agenda. It's not the main agenda because usually, so cybersecurity, it's a very, very specific AI point of perspective, and we're and you have to see it on a country-based level because data security has a different interpretation in every country. So for the cybersecurity, data security, making variables safe, we collaborate in Germany with the German Fraunhofer Institute, which are the key players in Germany for cybersecurity, I believe.
And I guess really to facilitate research, we need to start looking at harmonizing those regulations across different countries internationally, or otherwise we're going to run into major problems if we want to do truly population-based research. So you alluded there to a wearable that collects some data about patients with atopic dermatitis. Have you done any actual in vivo studies using these wearables as yet? And perhaps you could tell us about one such study?
Yeah, so we couldn't do a large study yet because of the European Medical Device Regulation. So we have three prototypes for our wearables, and I tested them myself, and also we had some PhD candidates who tested them by themselves, but we were not allowed so far to do a clinical study because we have to get the approval as a medical device to put it into patients. But we're almost there, so we're waiting for the approval by May or June, and then I'm very happy to tell you the results next time. But individually, I tested myself, as I said, and it works quite well. So again, because it's not about the single time point of a measurement, it's just looking at the pattern. And sometimes we then looking at a pattern for every single day for half a year, then of course it's very powerful.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So not about the single time point, but looking with a bird's eye view over a longer period. And can I ask, do you see a role for wearables ultimately having a purpose in drug delivery?
Yeah. So definitely. The newest wearables published in Nature, so they're all prototypes, of course. They're far away from clinical routine. But they're connected to so-called minimally invasive needles, basically.
So these are the micro needles.
The micro needles. They can suck liquid. They can analyze every second amino acids. So you can track any biomarker. And then, of course, you can have a closed loop system, just as we have today for diabetes.
Insulin, to get a drug. Yes.
And then it's very individual. Then we don't give a biological for atopic dermatitis every 8 weeks, every 2 weeks, but only when the level shows us, okay, now you have to give, now the pump has to deliver
IL-17 or whatever. Yeah, exactly. God, so the potential is absolutely enormous, and it would be a step towards truly individualized programs of care. I mean, one thing I was fascinated by in the editorial that you wrote for the JEADV clinical practice was this concept of being able to measure, well, stress hormones and thus indirectly stress in atopic dermatitis. And presumably that would be a really exciting thing to look at because all of our patients, be they psoriasis or eczema patients, tell us that when they go through a period of stress, that they find that their skin worsens. But this would be a really objective way of measuring that. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about how you would go about measuring stress or the surrogate measures that you would use?
Yeah, I agree. That's where we want to go. And that's a fascinating point. And we also have a prototype for measuring hormones in sweat. Not only stress hormones, cortisol and so on, but also sexual hormones. And the stress hormones, we are aiming to assess it in atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. and the sexual hormones for a lot of questions concerning gender medicine. So just imagine a female developing atopic dermatitis at the age of 6, and then it's completely gone away during pregnancy, or the other way around. So there has to be a link. And measuring cortisol and sweat actually has a long tradition for a lot of armies worldwide to train their soldiers, but also for professional sports athletes clubs. So not only soccer, but also football. I don't know if it's true, but that's what I was told, to practice penalty shooting, for example, to find the most stress-resistant player. And then not only by assessing, looking at the player, but also assessing his cortisol level, assessing his objectively measured stress level. And again, and that's so fascinating, because at the end of the day, I think it's just going to be a puzzle piece, because there's something called the ethmic biomarker. And the ethmic biomarker is a biomarker on how we move. And just imagine someone with a psoriasis developing a psoriasis arthritis. He will move differently because there might be some pain, and it's hard for us humans to tell a difference. But by tracking the way we move every single day, these ethmic biomarkers, variables, they will be able to predict the individual development of psoriasis arthritis in this use case, but also for other comorbidities. And that's what I really believe, is that variables are amazing. We can measure cortisol, we can measure whatever in the sweat, but also in the blood. But then we have to see it we have to see the big picture, connecting it to other data we're collecting. And then don't look at the single snapshot of data, look at the pattern.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. So in theory, to take your example of elite sports, if you were Bayern Munich or Arsenal looking to, you know, find your next best striker, you're saying that maybe by measuring their response to stress and their response in certain situations, you might, yeah, I guess you could prognosticate about what their performance might. I mean, the implications are very sort of far reaching. And so we've come to sort of towards the end of the time, and I always like to finish with a little sort of teaser question for my guest. And you mentioned earlier, Alex, that you have you're very fond of a gadget, and you have lots of technology in your home. Can you tell the listeners what is your top gadget at home and why?
Top gadget at home is, it's a automatically sprinkling tool for gardening.
Ah, so you don't have to water.
It makes life much, much, much easier.
Yes, I think that's probably going to be something of the future, taking away the jobs that we don't like to do and doing them in a more efficient
but actually,
way.
Sarah, it's not that I don't like to do it. It's just that I don't think about it, or when I'm traveling, I just forget my farn, and I have a huge farn, you know, the plant. Mm-hmm. And it's a closed loop system, so it measures the humidity and then it gives in, it adds water.
Word.
I can look at it on my smartphone, so I really love it.
So your fern has a wearable, effectively.
Basically, yes. Yeah.
Very reassuring to know that your garden will always be green, Alex. Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting to hear about your research area, which I wish you all the very best with, because it sounds extraordinarily exciting. And roll on the approval of the medical devices that makes it possible. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah.
We appreciate you joining us. And please make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or otherwise you can find us on any major podcast provider. If you are a regular listener to our podcast, we would love to hear from you. Your feedback will help us improve the show and develop episodes that you are interested in hearing. To participate in the short survey, simply follow the link in the show notes of this episode. Thank you for your support. It means a lot. We look forward to hearing from you. Until the next episode, take care of your skin.